Welcome back to the Florida History Podcast. I'm Carter Krishnire.
And I'm Robert Bucciolato.
It kind of feels like it was the roaring 90s in a way, like the roaring 20s. And Disney, the amusement parks, the popularity of the Disney parks peaked in the 90s. But there were many, many things that were beginning, cracks, facades that were beginning to show that maybe now with some hindsight, which is why you do history podcasts and history books and history analysis in the future and not at the moment. The 90s really kind of was the beginning of the it's not the end. I'm looking for the right term. The beginning of the decline of the Disney brand and the Disney amusement park franchises.
Well, I will say this. You can always tell by how much a historian is enjoying the present by how much history they're writing. And I can tell you, dear listener, that throughout that entire glorious decade that was the 1990s, I don't think me and my fellow co-host ever once thought about writing history through it.
No, right.
It was just a wonderful time to be alive. And when it was 1990, Disney was riding high. They were doing good. And Michael Eisner announced that the 1990s was going to be the Disney decade. Everything was cooking at full cylinder. The parks were looking good. They finally turned the animation department around. It was the Disney Renaissance. They were investing into this quirky little company that said that they were getting ready to start making animated films, but only with computers, called Pixar. Things were just, they were shaping up really, really well for Disney. On top of that, Disney released a movie called Beauty and the Beast, which was the first animated film in history to be nominated for Best Picture for an Academy Award, and major renovations to MGM Studios were released, and this third gate was finally producing the kind of benefits that Eisner had hoped it would when it opened earlier the previous few years. So what they decide to do is they're going to take these parks that were always a little bit underdeveloped and they're going to put money into it. They got money to spend and they're going to spend it on new developing immersive theme park attractions. They're going to go into the telecommunication business and do a lot more virtual reality rides, a lot more new and innovative shows. They've been producing these great animated films that have been popular with the kids. So as a result, they have a fresh new crop for the first time in decades, a fresh new crop of IPs that they can capitalize on. It was just a really booming time for them. And then they made the fateful decision. They said, well, you know, we got Orlando. Okay. We got the little guy Disneyland. Okay. Over there. We're doing really good with Tokyo Disney over there. Why don't we try our hand in Europe? And that's right there, effectively ended in 1993, the Disney decade, because what they did had ramifications throughout the entire empire, and in particular, development and the amount of money they were willing to spend in Orlando, Florida. And that was Euro Disney. Without question, the most beautiful theme park that was ever created. Only problem, it was in France, and nobody in France wanted it. See, Michael Eisner thought that by calling it Euro Disney, that it was somehow exciting and interesting and jet-setting. What he failed to realize was that everybody on the continent regarded it as Euro trash. And to make matters worse, all of those little heartaches and headaches that we talked about with the development of Disney World, angry locals that didn't want to be wakened up due to traffic and theme park noises and fireworks. Well, they had that over there in France. And to put it mildly, if you had to choose between a couple of crackers in Florida to deal with or a nation that beheaded its own king and queen, I would choose the crackers. They not only made Eisner and Disney's life a absolute living hell for the next 2 years, but when the park actually opened, they detonated bombs, literal bombs, on the rail track and subway lines that linked Epcot Disney. The result was that Disney suffered its worst opening day totals in park history. They were projecting that anywhere between 25 to 55,000 people would enter the gates the first day in Euro Disney, and as a result, about 15,000 people did. And it was not only the first Disney theme park to not make the top 10 list for most visited theme park attractions globally, but it didn't even make the top 3 for the nation of France. It was a monumental failure, and it cost the actual Disney brand billions of dollars. So as a result of the failure of Euro Disney, Disney decided, moving forward, that they were going to do things on the cheap. And unfortunately for us, as is always the case, the state of Florida would suffer the most. But before we talk a little bit about that, dear sir, what was 90s Disney like?
So, first off, MGM became the cool park. Although I wasn't cool, so I didn't go to the cool park. but Epcot still had Horizons, which had become a cult classic by that point, among people who were in their teen years or in college, like I was at the time. The Living Seas had become kind of acceptable. Okay, it wasn't SeaWorld, but it was okay. And Spaceship Earth, everybody loved. We had accepted the fact that World Showcase wasn't going to be built out the way it was supposed to. We had all seen the ads for the Switzerland Matterhorn that was never built, and the Soviet Union Pavilion with the Kremlin, the replica of the Kremlin that was never built because the Soviet Union collapsed. All of those things, but it was a kind of a happy place. And then over at the Magic Kingdom, and this is probably going to be a good segue for some of the other portions of this discussion, we had the classics really kind of had aged well. It's a Small World had aged well. Country Bear Jamboree had aged well. The Tiki Room, which we're going to certainly talk about, had really aged well, right? That was a lot of people's favorites. Mr. Toad's Wild Ride was kind of an essence of Disney. Eastern Airlines had collapsed, but there was a Delta Dream Flight that replaced it. That was kind of okay. It's the same thing. It's just, you know, you're doing Delta instead of Eastern, and
I only knew the Delta. So yeah, for me, I loved the Delta.
Yeah, and it was effectively the same ride. So it was the same thing. The roller coasters were the same in the Magic Kingdom, and then I think that you had still the Hall of Presidents and the Carousel of Progress, and there was a certain pride. I remember at UF in one of my friend groups, like one of the things that came up, we didn't have chat rooms and all that stuff then. The internet was just kind of coming online when I was in college. But I remember just at a party or something, everyone talking about, the coolest thing is when Lincoln stands up in the Call of Presidents. There was still something about Disney that felt good. But it was a fleeting moment, Robert, because And we're going to get to this. By the time we get to the early 2000s, it felt totally different. And a lot of those rides and attractions I just listed had been shut or had been altered or had been replaced. Another thing was the World of Energy. Everybody really was into it and thought it was cool. You know, you're watching a show and then you go through the dinosaur thing, and Figment had become a very popular character out of the Journey into Your Imagination. But for whatever reason, Eisner must have had different focus groups than us. Than us Floridians, us college students, because, if I were going to UF now like I did then, I would never go to Disney now. I would never waste my time there. But I went all the time, right? I mean, the two places you tended to go when you were at the University of Florida, two famous Florida attractions were you'd go to Disney or you'd go to Silver Springs. I think college students probably still do go to Silver Springs, right? It's so uniquely Florida and so close to Gainesville. But I don't think UF students or FSU students or even that many UCF students probably are heading to Disney. It's not cool anymore.
I think those comments have effectively killed any chance we had of a Disney sponsorship for this podcast. Look, you're absolutely right. I mean, you had, just as an example, in the 1990s, you were talking about the Hall of Presidents. The pull of Disney was so great. People forget this, but Bill Clinton actually agreed to be the first sitting president ever to actually record a specific monologue for the program.
Yep.
So it was a really interesting time where they would they would add on, they would build, they would enhance the rides. The Snow White ride used to be known for being incredibly scary. And for years, people would say, where's Snow White? Because Snow White was never actually in the ride, but all the other characters were. And the reality was that the actual rider was supposed to be the POV of Snow White, very much the same way that Peter Pan was. One of the things that changed in this time period was instead of just coming up with a new ride for Snow White or for Peter Pan, they realized that these rides were very important to the public and to the people that were coming to the park. So they made little additions. They made little changes. They had, for instance, Snow White visible at the start of the ride where she's climbing up to the stairs as if to go to sleep. And then the rest of the ride is her point of view as if she's in a dream. You had Peter Pan at the start of the ride getting ready to jump out of the window. And then, you know, your little ship goes out the window. And then you have this sort of great little black light model of England at, you know, from 100, you know, feet up in the air, and you're Peter Pan or you're with Peter Pan, and then he's featured throughout. So instead of just changing these very notable, well-known rides, they added to it. At the same time, you mentioned the Great Energy Pavilion in Epcot. This was also a period where they started doing things where Disney is now kind of become notorious for, where they've said, you know, okay, well, there's a ride that's a little bit dated. What do we do? And they say, well, let's add a celebrity to it because the kids like it. And so that's where it turned into Ellen DeGeneres's Journey of Energy or something like that. And so it was her, and it was Jamie Lee Curtis, and it was Albert Einstein playing Jeopardy. And throughout, it was Bill Nye the Science Guy taking her through basically a lecture of energy and looking at dinosaurs and stuff. So you didn't see a total scrapping of Disney identity of the past. You saw in the case of Ellen DeGeneres, a little bit more clumsy than in others, but you saw an update of 1970s Disney. At the same time, one of the things that Michael Eisner would say repeatedly at board meetings from the time that he had first became CEO and chairman of the board was that his teenage kids thought that Disney was for babies and they wanted to do more engaging, more scary rides. So that's where you had something like Alien Encounter take place, which was, is long since gone now, but I don't know if anybody had, who's listening went on it. But, for 7-8-year-old Bobby Bucciolato, it was a totally terrifying and exhilarating experience. And it was, one of the first instances where you had effectively a universal ride in Disney. So for a while, it was a really great marriage between enhancing the original concept of Disney while also bringing in some fresh new concepts. But when it came time to make these additions, many of which were already promised to the public, and you had a situation where the company was potentially going to take a $4 billion wash on Euro Disney, it was decided that they were going to start cutting the fat. At the same time, you had Disney, they had a new president, Michael Ovitz, who wasn't working out after 15 months. So he was let go in a severance packet that was like over $150 million. And they had just bought CBS because they were trying to renovate the sort of Disney presence on television. So money was tight. And instead of renovating, they started either tearing down or basically putting, scotch tape and band-aids on problems. And that was essentially when you started to see, it was very, very gradual, but that was when you started to see the transformation into the modern, very modern Disney problem that we have today, where extensions and improvements take a very, very long time, and the park has a feeling as though there's whole sections of it that are either dead or empty or underdeveloped. That was not the case in the 1990s. Every part of those parks was bustling.
So, Robert, let's leave it there for this week. We're going to pick up next week talking a little bit about Disney and some of the changes post the infamously long tenure of Michael Ovitz as Disney president. And by the way, I'm being sarcastic when I say infamously long. We'll talk to you next week.